Part 5. The Ritual of Chud. It is not to be done. The seepage has rotted out the curtain. The mesh is decayed. Loosen the flesh from the machine. Build no more bridges. Through what air will you fly to span the continents? Let the words fall any way at all, that they may hit love aslant. It will be a rare visitation. They want to rescue too much. The flood has done its work. William Carlos Williams, Patterson. Look and remember. Look upon this land, far, far across the factories and the grass. Surely there, surely they will let you pass. Speak then and ask the forest and the loam. What do you hear? What does the land command? The earth is taken. This is not your home. Carl Shapiro, Travelogue for Exiles. Chapter 19, In the Watches of the Night. 1. The Derry Public Library, 1:15 a.m. When Ben Hanscom finished the story of the silver slugs, they wanted to talk, but Mike told them he wanted them all to get some sleep. "You've had enough for now," he said. But Mike was the one who looked as if he had had enough. His face was tired and drawn, and Beverly thought he looked physically ill.
"But we're not done," Eddie said. "What about the rest of it? I still don't remember."
"Mike's rubber right," Bill said. "Either we'll remember or we won't."
"I think we will.
We've remembered all that we need to."
"Maybe all that's good for us," Richie suggested.
Mike nodded. "We'll meet tomorrow." Then he glanced at the clock. "Later today, I mean."
"Here?" Beverly asked.
Mike shook his head slowly.
"I suggest we meet on Kansas Street, where Bill used to hide his bike."
"We're going down into the Barrens?" Eddie said, and suddenly shivered. Mike nodded again. There was a moment of quiet while they looked around at each other. Then Bill got to his feet, and the others rose with him.
"I want you all to be careful for the rest of the night," Mike said. "It's Ben here. It can be wherever you are. But this meeting has made me feel better."
He looked at Bill.
"I'd say it still can be done, wouldn't you, Bill?"
Bill nodded slowly.
"Yes, I think it still can be done."
"It will know that too," Mike said, "and it will do whatever it can to slug the odds in its favor."
"What do we do if it shows up?" Richie asked.
"Hold our noses, shut our eyes, turn around 3 times and think good thoughts? Puff some magic dust in its face? Sing old Elvis Presley songs? What?"
Mike shook his head. "If I could tell you that, there would be no problem, would there?
All I know is that there's another force. At least, there was when we were kids. That wanted us to stay alive and do the job. Maybe it's still there."
He shrugged. It was a weary gesture. "I thought 2, maybe as many as 3 of you would be gone by the time we started our meeting tonight. Missing or dead. Just seeing you turn up gave me reason to hope."
Richie looked at his watch. 1:15. "How the time flies when you're having fun, right, Haystack?"
"Beep, beep, Richie," Ben said and smiled wanly.
"You want to walk back to the townhouse with me, Beverly?" Bill asked.
"All right." She was putting on her coat.
The library seemed very silent now, shadowy, frightening. Bill felt the last 2 days catching up with him all at once, piling up on his back. If it had just been weariness, that would have been okay, but it was more. A feeling that he was cracking up, dreaming, having delusions of paranoia, a sensation of being watched. "Maybe I'm really not here at all," he thought. "Maybe I'm in Dr. Seward's lunatic asylum, with the Count's crumbling townhouse next door, and Renfield just across the hall, him with his flies and me with my monsters. Both of us sure the party is really going on and dressed to the nines for it. Not in tuxedos, but in straight waistcoats."
"What about you, Richie?"
Richie shook his head.
"I'm going to let Haystack and Casbrack lead me home," he said. "Right, fellers?"
"Sure," Ben said. He looked briefly at Beverly, who was standing close to Bill, and felt a pain he had almost forgotten.
A new memory trembled, almost within his grasp, then floated away.
"What about you, Mike?" Bill asked. "Want to walk with Bev and me?"
Mike shook his head.
"I've got to..."
That was when Beverly screamed, a high-pitched sound in the stillness.
The vaulted dome overhead picked it up, and the echoes were like the laughter of banshees flying and flapping around them. Bill turned toward her. Richie dropped his sport coat as he was taking it off the back of his chair. There was a crash of glass as Eddie's arm swept an empty gin bottle onto the floor. Beverly was backing away from them, her hands held out, her face as white as good bond paper, her eyes deep in dusky purple sockets bulged.
"My hands," she screamed. "My hands."
"What?" Bill began, and then he saw the blood dripping slowly between her shaking fingers. He started forward and felt sudden lines of painful warmth cross his own hands. The pain was not sharp. It was more like the pain one sometimes feels in an old healed wound. The old scars on his palms, the ones which had reappeared in England, had broken open and were bleeding. He looked sideways and saw Eddie Kasprak peering stupidly down at his own hands. They were also bleeding. So were Mike's, and Richie's, and Ben's.
"We're in it to the end, aren't we?" Beverly said.
She had begun to cry. This sound was also magnified in the library's still emptiness. The building itself seemed to be weeping with her. Bill thought that if he had to listen to that sound for long, he would go mad.
"God help us, we're in it to the end,"
she sobbed, and a runner of snot depended from one of her nostrils. She wiped it off with the back of one shaking hand, and more blood dripped on the floor.
"Quick, quick, quick," Bill said, and seized Eddie's hand.
"What?"
"Quick."
He held out his other hand, and after a moment Beverly took it. She was still crying.
"Yes," Mike said.
He looked dazed, almost drugged.
"Yes, that's right, isn't it? It's starting again, isn't it, Bill? It's all starting to happen again."
Yes, I think.
Mike took Eddie's hand, and Richie took Beverly's other hand. For a moment, Ben only looked at them. And then, like a man in a dream, he raised his bloody hands to either side and stepped between Mike and Richie. He grasped their hands. The circle closed.
"Ah, Chud. This is the ritual of Chud, and the turtle cannot help us."
Bill tried to scream, but no sound came out. He saw Eddie's head tilt back, the cords on his neck standing out. Bev's hips bucked twice, fiercely, as if in an orgasm as short and sharp as the crack of a .22 pistol. Mike's mouth moved strangely, seeming to laugh and grimace at the same time. In the silence of the library, doors banged open and shut, the sound rolling like bowling balls. In the periodicals room, magazines flew in a windless hurricane. In Carol Danner's office, the library's IBM typewriter whirred into life and typed, "He thrusts, his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. He thrusts his fists against the..." The type ball jammed. The typewriter sizzled and uttered a thick electronic belch as everything inside overloaded. In stack two, the shelf of occult books suddenly tipped over, spilling Edgar Cayce, Nostradamus, Charles Fort, and the Apocrypha everywhere. Bill felt an exulting sense of power. He was dimly aware that he had an erection and that every hair on his head was standing up straight. The sense of force in the completed circle was incredible. All the doors in the library slammed shut in unison. The grandfather clock behind the checkout desk chimed once. Then it was gone, as if someone had flicked off a switch. They dropped their hands, looked at each other, dazed. No one said anything. As the sense of power ebbed, Bill felt a terrible sense of doom creep over him. He looked at their white, strained faces, and then down at his hands. Blood was smeared there, but the wounds which Stan Uris had made with a jagged piece of Coke bottle in August 1958 had closed up again, leaving only crooked white lines like knotted twine. He thought, "This was the last time the seven of us were together. The day Stan made those cuts in the Barrens. Stan's not here. He's dead. And this is the last time the six of us are going to be together. I know it. I feel it." Beverly was pressed against him, trembling. Bill put an arm around her. They all looked at him, their eyes huge and bright in the dimness, the long table where they had sat, littered with empty bottles, glasses, and overflowing ashtrays, a little island of light. "That's enough," Bill said huskily. "Enough entertainment for one evening. We'll save the ballroom dancing for another time."
"I remembered," Beverly said. She looked up at Bill, her eyes huge, her pale cheeks wet.
I remembered everything. My father finding out about you guys. Running. Bowers and Chris and Huggins. How I ran. The tunnel. The birds. It. I remember everything.
Yeah, Richie said. I do too.
Eddie nodded.
The pumping station. Bill said, and how Eddie...
Go back now, Mike said. Get some rest. It's late.
Walk with us, Mike, Beverly said.
No, I have to lock up. And I have to write a few things down. The minutes of the meeting, if you like.
I won't be long. Go ahead.
They moved toward the door, not talking much. Bill and Beverly were together, Eddie, Richie, and Ben behind them. Bill held the door for her, and she murmured thanks. As she went out onto the wide granite steps, Bill thought how young she looked, how vulnerable. He was dismally aware that he might be falling in love with her again. He tried to think of Audra, but Audra seemed far away. She would be sleeping in their house in Fleet now as the sun came up and the milkman began his rounds. Derry sky had clouded over again, and a low ground fog lay across the empty street in thick runners. Farther up the street, the Derry community house, narrow, tall, Victorian, brooded in blackness. Bill thought, and whatever walked in community house walked alone. He had to stifle a wild cackle. Their footfalls seemed very loud. Beverly's hand touched his, and Bill took it gratefully.
It started before we were ready, she said.
Would we ever have been ready?
You would have been, Big Bill.
The touch of her hand was suddenly both wonderful and necessary. He wondered what it would be like to touch her breasts for the second time in his life, and suspected that before this long night was over, he would know.
Fuller now, mature, and his hand would find hair when he cut the swelling of her mons veneris.
He thought, I loved you, Beverly. I love you.
Ben loved you. He loves you. We loved you then. We love you now. We better, because it's starting. No way out now.
He glanced behind and saw the library half a block away. Richie and Eddie were on the top step. Ben was standing at the bottom, looking after them. His hands were stuffed in his pockets. His shoulders were slumped, and seen through the drifting lens of the low fog, he might almost have been 11 again. If he had been able to send Ben a thought, Bill would have sent this one.
It doesn't matter, Ben. The love is what matters. The caring. It's always the desire, never the time. Maybe that's all we get to take with us when we get out of the blue and into the black. Cold comfort, maybe, but better than no comfort at all.
My father knew, Beverly said suddenly. I came home one day from the Barrens, and he just knew.
Did I ever tell you what he used to say to me when he was mad?
What?
I worry about you, Bevy. That's what he used to say. I worry a lot.
She laughed and shivered at the same time.
I think he meant to hurt me, Bill. I mean, he'd hurt me before, but that last time was different. He was, well, in many ways, he was a strange man. I loved him. I loved him very much, but...
She looked at him, perhaps wanting him to say it for her. He wouldn't. It was something she was going to have to say for herself sooner or later. Lies and self-deceptions had become a ballast they could not afford.
I hated him too, she said,
and her hand bore down convulsively upon Bill's for a long second.
I never told that to anyone in my life before. I thought God would strike me dead if I ever said it out loud.
Say it again, then.
No, I...
Go on. It'll hurt, but maybe it's festered in there long enough. Say it.
I hated my dad, she said, and began to sob helplessly. I hated him. I was scared of him. I hated him. I could never be a good enough girl to suit him, and I hated him. I did. But I loved him, too.
He stopped and held her tight. Her arms went around him in a panicky grip. Her tears wet the side of his neck. He was very conscious of her body, ripe and firm. He moved his torso away from hers slightly, not wanting her to feel the erection he was getting. But she moved against him again.
We'd spent the morning down there, she said, playing tag or something like that, something harmless. We hadn't even talked about it that day, at least not then. We usually talked about it every day at some point, though, remember?
Yes, he said, at some point, I remember.
It was overcast, hot.
We played most of the morning. I went home around 11:30. I thought I'd have a sandwich and a bowl of soup after I took a shower, and then I'd go back and play some more. My parents were both working.
But he was there. He was home. He...
2. Lower Main Street, 11:30 a.m. Threw her across the room before she had even gotten all the way through the door. A startled scream was jerked out of her and then cut off as she hit the wall with shoulder-numbing force. She collapsed onto their sagging sofa, looking around wildly. The door to the front hall banged shut. Her father had been standing behind it.
"I worry about you, Bevy," he said. "Sometimes I worry a lot. You know that. I tell you that, don't I? You bet I do."
"Daddy, what?"
He was walking slowly toward her across the living room, his face thoughtful, sad, deadly. She didn't want to see that last, but it was there, like the blind shine of dirt on still water. He was nibbling reflectively on a knuckle of his right hand. He was dressed in his khakis, and when she glanced down, she saw that his high-topped shoes were leaving tracks on her mother's carpet.
"I'll have to get the vacuum out," she thought incoherently. "Vacuum that up. If he leaves me able to vacuum, if he..."
It was mud. Black mud. Her mind side-slipped alarmingly. She was back in the Barrens with Bill, Richie, Eddie, and the others. There was black, viscous mud like the kind on Daddy's shoes down there in the Barrens, in the swampy place where the stuff Richie called bamboo stood in a skeletal white grove. When the wind blew, the stalks rattled together hollowly, producing a sound like voodoo drums. And had her father been down in the Barrens? Had her father? Whap! His hand rocketed down in a wide, sweeping orbit and struck her face. Her head thudded back against the wall. He hooked his thumbs in his belt and looked at her with that expression of deadly, disconnected curiosity. She felt a trickle of blood running warmly from the left corner of her lower lip.
"I have seen you getting big," he said, and she thought he would say something more. But for the time being, that seemed to be all.
"Daddy, what are you talking about?"
she asked in a low, trembling voice.
"If you lie to me, I'll beat you within an inch of your life, Bevy," he said, and she realized with horror that he wasn't looking at her.
He was looking at the Currier and Ives picture over her head on the wall above the sofa. Her mind side-slipped crazily again, and she was 4, sitting in the bathtub with her blue plastic boat and her Popeye soap. Her father, so big and so well-loved, was kneeling beside her, dressed in gray twill pants and a strappy T-shirt, a washcloth in one hand and a glass of orange soda in the other, soaping her back and saying,
"Let me see those ears, Bevy. Your ma needs taters for supper."
And she could hear her small self giggling, looking up at his slightly grizzled face, which she had then believed must be eternal.
I won't lie, Daddy," she said. "What's wrong?"
Her view of him was gradually shivering apart as the tears came.
"You've been down there in the Barrens with a gang of boys?"
Her heart leaped. Her eyes dropped to his mud-caked shoes again. That black, clingy mud. If you stepped into it too deep, it would suck your sneaker or your loafer right off. And both Richie and Bill believed that, if you went in all the way, it turned to quick mud.
"I play down there sometime."
Whap! The hand covered with hard calluses rocketing down again. She cried out, hurt, afraid. That look on his face scared her, and the way he wouldn't look at her scared her, too. There was something wrong with him. He had been getting worse. What if he meant to kill her? What if...
"Oh, stop it, Beverly. He's your father, and fathers don't kill daughters."
He lost control then. What if...
"What have you let them do to you?"
"Do? What?"
She had no idea what he meant.
"Take your pants off."
Her confusion increased. Nothing he said seemed connected to anything else. Trying to follow him made her feel ill, seasick almost.
"What? Why?"
His hand rose. She flinched back.
"Take them off, Bevy. I want to see if you are intact."
Now there was a new image, crazier than the rest. She saw herself pulling her jeans off and one of her legs coming off with them. Her father belting her around the room as she tried to hop away from him on her one good leg. Daddy shouting,
"I knew you wasn't intact. I knew it. I knew it."
"Daddy, I don't know what..."
His hand came down, not slapping this time, but clutching. It bit into her shoulder with furious strength. She screamed. He pulled her up and for the first time looked directly into her eyes. She screamed again at what she saw there. It was... nothing. Her father was gone. and Beverly suddenly understood that she was alone in the apartment with it, alone with it on this dozy August morning. There was not the thick sense of power and untinctured evil she had felt in the house on Niebold Street a week and a half ago. It had been diluted somehow by her father's essential humanity, but it was here, working through him. He threw her aside. She struck the coffee table, tripped over it, and went sprawling on the floor with a cry.
"This is how it happens," she thought. "I'll tell Bill so he understands. It's everywhere in Derry. It just fills the hollow places, that's all."
She rolled over. Her father was walking toward her. She skidded away from him on the seat of her jeans, her hair in her eyes.
"I know you've been down there," he said. "I was told. I didn't believe it. I didn't believe my bevy would be hanging around with a gang of boys. Then I seen you myself this morning. My bevy with a bunch of boys. Not even 12 and hanging around with a bunch of boys."
This latter thought seemed to send him into a fresh rage. It trembled through his scrawny frame like volts.
"Not even 12 years old," he shouted, and fetched a kick at her thigh that made her scream.
His jaw snapped over this fact or concept or whatever it was to him like the jaws of a hungry dog worrying a piece of meat.
"Not even 12. Not even 12. Not even 12.
He kicked. Beverly scrambled away. They had worked their way into the kitchen area of the apartment now. His work boot struck the drawer under the stove, making the pots and pans inside jangle.
"Don't you run from me, Bevy," he said. "You don't want to do that, or it'll be the worse for you. Believe me now. Believe your dad. This is serious. Hanging around with the boys, letting them do God knows what to you. Not even 12. That's serious, Christ knows."
He grabbed her and jerked her to her feet by her shoulder.
"You're a pretty girl," he said. "There's plenty of people happy to ruin a pretty girl. Plenty of pretty girls willing to be ruined. You've been a slut child to them boys, Bevy."
At last she understood what it had put in his head. Except part of her knew the thought might almost have been there all along, that it might only have used the tools that had been there just lying around, waiting to be picked up.
"No, Daddy, no, Daddy."
"I seen you smoking," he bellowed.
This time he struck her with the palm of his hand, hard enough to send her reeling back in drunken strides to the kitchen table, where she sprawled, a flare of agony in the small of her back. The salt and pepper shakers fell to the floor. The pepper shaker broke. Black flowers bloomed and disappeared before her eyes. Sound seemed too deep. She saw his face, something in his face. He was looking at her chest. She was suddenly aware that her blouse had come untucked and that she wasn't wearing a bra. As of yet, she owned only one, a training bra. Her mind side-slipped back to the house at Niebold Street when Bill had given her his shirt. She had been aware of the way her breasts poked at the thin cotton material, but their occasional skittering glances had not bothered her. These had seemed perfectly natural. And Bill's look had seemed more than natural. It had seemed warm and wanted, if deeply dangerous. Now she felt guilt mixed with her terror. Was her father so wrong? Hadn't she had...
"You been a slut child to them?"
Thoughts? Bad thoughts? Thoughts of whatever it was that he was talking about?
It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing as the way...
"You've been a slut child.
He's looking at me now. Not the same."
She tucked her blouse back in.
"Bevy."
"Daddy, we just play. That's all. We play. We don't do anything like... anything bad. We..."
"I seen you smoking,"
he said again, walking toward her. His eyes moved across her chest and her narrow, uncurved hips. He chanted suddenly in a high schoolboy's voice that frightened her even more.
"A girl who will chew gum will smoke. A girl who will smoke will drink. And a girl who will drink, everyone knows what a girl like that will do." "I didn't do anything,"
she screamed at him as his hands descended on her shoulders. He was not pinching or hurting now. His hands were gentle. And that was somehow scariest of all.
"Beverly," he said with the inarguable mad logic of the totally obsessed. "I seen you with boys. Now you want to tell me what a girl does with boys down in all that trash wood if it ain't what a girl does on her back?"
"Let me alone,"
she cried at him. The anger flashed up from a deep well she had never suspected. The anger made a bluish-yellow flame in her head. It threatened her thoughts. All the times he had scared her, all the times he had shamed her, all the times he had hurt her.
"You just let me alone."
"Don't talk to your daddy like that,"
he said, sounding startled.
I didn't do what you're saying. I never did.
Maybe. Maybe not. I'm going to check and make sure. I know how. Take your pants off.
No.
His eyes widened, showing yellowed cornea all the way around the deep blue irises.
What did you say?
I said no.
His eyes were fixed on hers, and perhaps he saw the blazing anger there, the bright upsurge of rebellion.
Who told you?
Bevy.
Who told you we play down there? Was it a stranger? Was it a man dressed in orange and silver? Did he wear gloves? Did he look like a clown, even if he wasn't a clown? What was his name?
Bevy, you want to stop.
No, you want to stop, she told him.
He swung his hand again, not open, but this time closed in a fist meant to break something. Beverly ducked. His fist whistled over her head and crashed into the wall. He howled and let go of her, putting the fist to his mouth. She backed away from him in quick, mincing steps.
You come back here.
No, she said. You want to hurt me. I love you, Daddy, but I hate you when you're like this. You can't do it anymore. It's making you do it, but you let it in.
I don't know what you're talking about, he said, but you better get over here to me. I am not going to ask you no more.
No, she said, beginning to cry again.
Don't make me come over there and collect you, Bevy. You're going to be one sorry little girl if I have to do that. Come to me.
Tell me who told you, she said, and I will.
He leaped at her with such scrawny cat-like agility that, although she suspected such a leap was coming, she was almost caught. She fumbled for the kitchen doorknob, pulled the door open just wide enough so she could slip through, and then she was running down the hall toward the front door, running in a dream of panic, as she would run from Mrs. Kirst 27 years later. Behind her, Al Marsh crashed against the door, slamming it shut again, cracking it down the center.
You get back here right now, Bevy, he howled, yanking it open and coming after her.
The front door was on the latch. She had come home the back way. One of her trembling hands worked at the lock while the other yanked fruitlessly at the knob. Behind, her father howled again, the sound of an,
take those pants off, slut child, animal.
She turned the lock knob and the front door finally swept open. Hot breath plunged up and down in her throat. She looked over her shoulder and saw him right behind her, reaching for her, grinning and grimacing, his yellow horsey teeth a bear trap in his mouth. Beverly bolted out through the screen door and felt his fingers skid down the back of her blouse without catching hold. She flew down the steps, overbalanced, and went sprawling on the concrete walkway, erasing the skin from both knees.
You get back here now, Bevy, or before God, I'll whip the skin off you.
He came down the steps and she scrambled to her feet, holes in the legs of her jeans,
your pants off,
her kneecaps sizzling blood, exposed nerve endings singing, Onward Christian Soldiers. She looked back and here he came again, Al Marsh, janitor and custodian, a gray man dressed in khaki pants and a khaki shirt with two flap pockets, a key ring attached to his belt by a chain, his hair flying. But he wasn't in his eyes. The essential he who had washed her back and punched her in the gut and had done both because he worried about her, worried a lot. The he who had once tried to braid her hair when she was 7, made a botch of it, and then got giggling with her about the way it stuck out every way. The he who knew how to make cinnamon eggnogs on Sunday that tasted better than anything you could buy for a quarter at the dairy ice cream bar. The father he, male man of her life, delivering a mixed post from that other sexual state. None of that was in his eyes now. She saw blank murder there. She saw it there. She ran. She ran from it. Mr. Pasquale looked up, startled, from where he was watering his crabgrassy lawn and listening to the Red Sox game on a portable radio sitting on his porch rail. The Zinnerman kid stood back from the old Hudson Hornet, which they had bought for $25 and washed almost every day. One of them was holding a hose, the other a bucket of soap suds. Both were slack-jawed. Mrs. Denton looked out of her second-floor apartment, one of her 6 daughters' dresses in her lap, more mending in a basket on the floor, her mouth full of pins. Little Lars Theramenius pulled his red ball flyer wagon quickly off the cracked sidewalk and stood on Bucky Pasquale's dying lawn. He burst into tears as Bevy, who had spent a patient morning that spring showing him how to tie his sneakers so they would stay tied, flashed by him, screaming, her eyes wide. A moment later, her father passed, howling at her, and Lars, who was then 3 and who would die 12 years later in a motorcycle accident, saw something terrible and inhuman in Mr. Marsh's face. He had nightmares for 3 weeks after. In them, he saw Mr. Marsh turning into a spider inside his clothes. Beverly ran. She was perfectly aware that she might be running for her life. If her father caught her now, it wouldn't matter that they were on the street. People did crazy things in Derry sometimes. She didn't have to read the newspapers or know the town's peculiar history to understand that. If he caught her, he would choke her, or beat her, or kick her. And when it was over, someone would come and collect him, and he would sit in a cell the way Eddie Corcoran's stepfather was sitting in a cell, dazed and uncomprehending. She ran toward downtown, passing more and more people as she went. They stared, first at her, then at her pursuing father. And they looked surprised, some of them even amazed. But what was on their faces went no further. They looked, and then they went on toward wherever they had been going. The air circulating in her lungs was growing heavier now. She crossed the canal, feet pounding on cement while cars rumbled over the heavy wooden slats of the bridge to her right. To her left, she could see the stone semicircle where the canal went under the downtown area. She cut suddenly across Main Street, oblivious to the honking horns and squealing brakes. She went right because the Barrens lay in that direction. It was still almost a mile away, and if she was to get there, she would somehow have to outdistance her father on the grueling slope of Upmile Hill, or one of the even steeper side streets. But that was all there was. "Come back, you little bitch, I'm warning you." As she gained the sidewalk on the far side of the street, she snatched another glance behind her, the heavy weight of her red hair shifting over her shoulder as she did. Her father was crossing the street, as heedless of the traffic as she had been, his face a bright, sweaty red. She ducked down an alley that ran behind Warehouse Row. This was the rear of the buildings which fronted on Upmile Hill. Star Beef, Armor Meat Packing, Hemp Hill Storage and Warehousing, Eagle Beef and Kosher Meats. The alley was narrow and cobbled, made narrower still by the bunches of fuming garbage cans and bins set out here. The cobbles were slimy with God knew what offal and ordure. There was a mixture of smells, some bland, some sharp, some simply titanic, but all spoke of meat and slaughter. Flies buzzed in clouds. From inside some of the buildings, she could hear the blood-curdling whine of bone saws. Her feet stuttered unevenly on the slick cobbles. One hip struck a galvanized garbage can, and packages of tripe wrapped in newspaper fell out like great meaty jungle blossoms. "You get right the hell back here, Bevy. I mean it now. Don't make it any worse than it already is, girl." Two men lounged in the loading doorway of the Kirshner Packing Works, munching thick sandwiches, open dinner buckets near at hand. "You in a woeful place, girl," one of them said mildly. "Looks like you going in the woodshed with your pa." The other laughed. He was gaining. She could hear his thundering footfalls and heavy respiration almost behind her now. Looking to her right, she could see the black wing of his shadow flying along the high board fence there. Then he yelled in surprise and fury as his feet slipped out from under him and he thumped to the cobblestones. He was up a moment later, no longer bellowing words, but only shrieking out his incoherent fury while the men in the doorway laughed and slapped each other on the back. The alley zigged to the left, and Beverly came to a skittering halt, her mouth opening in dismay. A city dumpster was parked across the alley's mouth. There was not even 9 inches of clearance on either side. Its motor was idling. Under that sound, barely audible, she could hear the murmur of conversation from the dumpster's cab. More men on lunch break. It lacked no more than 3 or 4 minutes of noon. Soon the courthouse clock would begin to chime the hour. She could hear him coming again, closing in. She threw herself down and hooked her way under the dumpster, using her elbows and wounded knees. The stink of exhaust and diesel fuel mixed with the smell of ripe meat and made her feel a kind of giddy nausea. In a way, the ease of her progress was worse. She was skidding greasily over a coating of slime and garbagey crud. She kept moving, once rising too high off the cobbles so that her back came in contact with the dumpster's hot exhaust pipe. She had to bite back a scream. "Beverly, you under there?" Each word separated from the last by an out-of-breath gasp for air. She looked back and met his eyes as he bent and peered under the truck. "Leave me alone," she managed. "You bitch," he replied in a thick, spit-choked voice. He threw himself flat, keys jingling, and began to crawl after her, using a grotesque swimming stroke to pull himself along. Beverly clawed her way from under the truck's cab, grabbed one of the huge tires, her fingers hooked their way into a tread up to the second knuckle, and yanked herself up. She banged her tailbone on the dumpster's front bumper, and then she was running again, heading up Mile Hill now, her blouse and jeans smeared with goop and stinking to high heaven. She looked back and saw her father's hands and freckled arms shoot out from under the dumpster's cab like the claws of some imagined childhood monster from under the bed. Quickly, hardly thinking at all, she darted between Feldman's storage and the Tracker Brothers' annex. This covert, too narrow even to be called an alley, was filled with broken crates, weeds, sunflowers, and, of course, more garbage. Beverly dived behind a pile of crates and crouched there. A few moments later, she saw her father pound by the mouth of the covert and on up the hill. Beverly got up and hurried to the far end of the covert. There was a chain-link fence here. She monkeyed to the top, got over, and worked her way down the far side. She was now on Derry Theological Seminary property. She ran up the manicured back lawn and around the side of the building. She could hear someone inside playing something classical on an organ. The notes seemed to engrave their pleasant, calm selves on the still air. There was a tall hedge between the seminary and Kansas Street. She peered through it and saw her father on the far side of the street, breathing hard, patches of sweat darkening his work shirt under the arms. He was peering around, hands on hips. His key ring twinkled brightly in the sun. Beverly watched him, also breathing hard, her heart beating rabbit fast in her throat. She was very thirsty, and her simmering smell disgusted her. "If I was drawn in a comic strip," she thought distractedly, "there'd be all those wavy stink lines coming up from me." Her father crossed slowly to the seminary side. Beverly's breath stopped. "Please, God, I can't run anymore. Help me, God. Don't let him find me." Al Marsh walked slowly down the sidewalk, directly past where his daughter crouched on the far side of the hedge. "Dear God, don't let him smell me." He didn't. Perhaps because, after a tumble in the alleyway and crawling under the dumpster himself, Al smelled as bad as she did. He walked on. She watched him go back down up Mile Hill until he was out of sight. Beverly picked herself up slowly. Her clothes were covered with garbage. Her face was dirty. Her back hurt where she had burned it on the exhaust pipe of the dumpster. These physical things paled before the confused swirl of her thoughts. She felt that she had sailed off the edge of the world, and none of the normal patterns of behavior seemed to apply. She could not imagine going home. But she could not imagine not going home. She had defied her father. Defied him. She had to push that thought away because it made her feel weak and trembly, sick to her stomach. She loved her father. Wasn't one of the Ten Commandments, "Honor thy mother and father, that thy days may be long upon the earth"? Yes. But he hadn't been himself, hadn't been her father, had, in fact, been someone completely different, an imposter. It. Suddenly she went cold as a terrible question occurred to her. Was this happening to the others, or something like it? She ought to warn them. They had hurt it, and perhaps now it was taking steps to assure itself that they would never hurt it again. And really, where else was there to go? They were the only friends she had. Bill. Bill would know what to do. Bill would tell her what to do. Bill would supply the what next. She stopped where the seminary walk joined the Kansas Street sidewalk and peered around the hedge. Her father was truly gone. She turned right and began to walk along Kansas Street toward the Barrens. Probably none of them would be there right now. They would be at home, eating their lunches. But they would be back. Meantime, she could go down into the cool clubhouse and try to get herself under some kind of control. She would leave the little window wide open so she could have some sunshine, and perhaps she would even be able to sleep. Her tired body and overstrained mind grasped eagerly at the thought. Sleep. Yes, that would be good. Her head drooped as she plodded past the last bunch of houses before the land grew too steep for houses and plunged down into the barrens. The barrens where, as incredible as it seemed to her, her father had been lurking and spying. She certainly did not hear footfalls behind her. The boys there were at great pains to be quiet. They had been outrun before. They did not intend to be outrun again. They drew closer and closer to her, walking cat soft. Belch and Victor were grinning, but Henry's face was both vacant and serious. His hair was uncombed and snarly. His eyes were as unfocused as Al Marsh's had been in the apartment. He held one dirty finger pressed over his lips in a shh gesture as they closed the distance from 70 feet to 50 to 30. Through that summer, Henry had been edging steadily out over some mental abyss, walking on a bridge that had grown relentlessly more and more narrow. On the day when he allowed Patrick Hochstetter to caress him,
That bridge had narrowed to a tightrope. The tightrope had snapped this morning. He had gone out into the yard, naked except for his ragged, yellowing undershorts, and looked up into the sky. The ghost of last night's moon still lingered there, and as he looked at it, the moon had suddenly changed to a skeletal, grinning face. Henry had fallen on his knees before this face, exalted with terror and joy. Ghost voices came from the moon. The voices changed, sometimes seemed to merge together in a soft babble that was barely understandable. But he sensed the truth, which was simply that all these voices were one voice, one intelligence. The voice told him to hunt up Belch and Victor and be at the corner of Kansas Street and Costello Avenue around noon. The voice told him he would know what to do then. Sure enough, the cunt had come bopping along. He waited to hear what the voice would tell him to do next. The answer came as they continued to close the distance. The voice came not from the moon, but from the sewer grating they were passing. The voice was low but clear. Belch and Victor glanced toward the grating in a dazed, almost hypnotized way, then back at Beverly. "Kill her," the voice from the sewer said. Henry Bowers reached into the pocket of his jeans and brought out a slim 9-inch-long instrument with imitation ivory inlays along its sides. A small chromium button glittered at one end of this dubious objet d'art. Henry pushed it. A 6-inch blade popped out of the slit at the end of the handle. He bounced the switchblade on his palm. He began to walk a little faster. Victor and Belch, still looking dazed, increased their own walking speed to keep up with him. Beverly did not hear them, precisely. That was not what made her turn her head as Henry Bowers closed the distance. Bent-kneed, shuffling, a frozen grin on his face, Henry was as silent as an Indian. No, it was simply a feeling too clear and direct and powerful to be denied of 3. The Derry Public Library, 1:55 a.m. Being watched. Mike Hanlon laid his pen aside and looked across the shadowy inverted bowl of the library's main room. He saw islands of light thrown by the hanging globes. He saw books fading into dimness. He saw the iron staircases making their graceful trellised spirals up to the stacks. He saw nothing out of place. All the same, he did not believe he was alone in here. Not anymore. After the others were gone, Mike had cleaned up with the care that was only habit. He was on autopilot, his mind a million miles and 27 years away. He dumped ashtrays, threw away the empty liquor bottles, putting a layer of waste over them so that Carol wouldn't be shocked, and the returnable cans in a box behind his desk. Then he got the broom and swept up the remains of the gin bottle Eddie had broken. When the table was clean, he went into the periodicals room and picked up the scattered magazines. As he did these simple chores, his mind sifted the stories they had told.